This is Rafflebix After Hours.
Hello, ladies, jelly spoons, denizens of the internet. It is Rack Addicts After Hours time. What I hope is your favourite podcast available on the internet. So yes, welcome. Episode 64, you're here with Ben. That's me. We've got Pete as well, the two-man band. Once again, though, we are joined with our favourite spacey bit later on. Starting with our general weekly catch-up. There's been a whole lot of very exciting nothing happening over in my neck of the woods, although, Pete, I hadn't told you this because I wanted it to be a bit of a surprise. I have just ordered a Soma Lyra 8.
Whoa. Really?
Yeah, well, I sold this up on Monicon.
A complete
it's
one?
Gone. Yes, indeed. I didn't buy the kit because the enclosure would be beyond my means, I think.
Yeah, that could be quite difficult. I think that might be the biggest challenge of the kit.
And the satisfying little pegs for the contacts. But yeah, I'll have one with me tomorrow. So next week I shall report back.
Where did you purchase it from?
Juno Records.
Okay, yeah, they're pretty good. They're very responsive with their deliveries. So
indeed. I've bought from them a few times before, so I'm feeling all right, but yeah, I'll report back on that next week.
I've bought a few things from Juno, and it's always been a good experience.
Mm.
So what inspired you to suddenly flash out the cash on that?
And jettison the subharmonicon there beforehand. I had watched a video of it ages ago, and you know, you have one of those videos that you've seen that just kind of keeps hovering, either in your recommended for some reason, because you've already seen it, and YouTube goes, you want to watch this again, don't you? Or because Google is listening, and it really knew that I already wanted to buy one. I've been sort of fascinated by it since it came out. I was into synths when it sort of appeared on the scene as this little weird, strange thing, and sort of getting into the more experimental end of music and enjoying kind of droney, textural stuff. Especially the kind of things that are on the cassettes that I've bought, though I haven't listened to them on the cassette, the albums. Particularly one by Ian O, of ModCaf fame, of course, Case 2 Subversion Therapy. There's a track on there called Spruchnummer, which is, yeah, industrial, droney, and really cool. So that kind of vibe has been appealing to me, and I just ended up watching too many videos one evening and thought, yeah, it's just got to happen. That's the story.
Well, and a quick rollback I caught at the beginning. You have got rid of the subharmonicon.
Yes, indeed. That one has gone. I think it's a case of it just wasn't what I thought it was going to be. The workflow is certainly interesting with the kind of the subdivisions of frequency, both for subharmonics in the audio range and also how you work with the tempo or the sequences. The sawtooth waveforms sound really thin, which is quite annoying. So if you want to kind of thicken up that sound, you've got to go drive pedal or you've got to go unquantized, so you can have kind of a little bit of a super saw detune kind of thing going on. It doesn't have an audio input, so you can't use the filter. I made a few sequences that were cool. I think it would really shine in a larger modular setup, which of course I now no longer have. So on its own, it just wasn't working for me. It wasn't grabbing my attention.
I don't know if some of our listeners are going to be disappointed. The subharmonicon episode was one of our best.
Oh no, I've betrayed our listeners.
Or most popular episodes that we've done
so
far.
I'm so sorry. It's kind of annoying because it did really excite me from when the Moogfest version appeared. And I thought, ooh, that's a fresh angle for making electronic tunes. And yeah, I enjoyed it. It's a cool box, but not a keeper, it seems.
Yeah.
I'm not really that worried about, you know, hanging on to things these days. Because I've bought so much and subsequently jettisoned it from my life. I'm kind of used to it now.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to be said for it. As I say, at least you don't sort of carry a lot of baggage, you know, sort of hoard stuff.
Yeah.
Which is an issue in its own Well, there it is, and there it's gone.
There it is, there it isn't. And like I said, I'll report back. That's actually, no, there is one more slightly interesting brewing over in my neck of the woods from this week. Telmo and I, and well, Telmo and P-Gypt Telmo and I were working on a bit of a video something. Got the files today, had a look through. There is a bit of a brewing over in this corner, so keep an eye on the P-Gypt social medias in the next week.
Okay, so it'll be, relatively soon that we'll see that.
Yes, indeed. Quite a short turnaround, but that's how I like them. I don't really work if there isn't a deadline screaming at me in the face. So, yeah.
I know the feeling. It's the sort of the ultimate motivation, isn't it?
Totally.
Nothing like a deadline to get things sorted out.
I mean, it's the only thing like a deadline that does anything for me. But yeah, that's been my week. So actually a little bit more interesting and exciting than the previous few. But what about you, Pete? What's been happening over there?
A couple of things. One, last week I mentioned that I was putting lots of equipment through the Strymon Night Sky, see which instruments were most complemented by the extremely long reverbs.
So DeepMind happened, and you said you did some piano with the motif, right?
Yeah, that was correct. And I'd put the sub 37 through it, but that was didn't really suit. It was okay on some sounds, but as the thing is predominantly very bassy, it didn't really go with it. But that led me to get really deep into the DeepMind, if that's a thing I can actually say. Deep into deep, the DeepMind.
Mind's deep mind.
Yeah, anyway, so very deep. Deeper than I've ever gone before, basically. I hadn't had the need previously, and it was the desktop one I have here. I've got the two. I've got the DeepMind 12 keyboard version and the DeepMind 12 desktop one. The desktop one I acquired secondhand and have had for 18 months. And when I was using it was the first time I've actually used it in that 18 months. So I hadn't really got into testing it. And there was a little issue. It's not a problem. It's got a floating VCA in the respect that the VCA is slightly unstable and seems to float around a few decibels.
Okay.
A few fractions of a decibel. And I don't know if you're aware on the DeepMind, if you touch any of the control surface on the major or the major controls on the control surface, it's then represented in the little the LED screen. And then it goes back to a kind of default setting once that you stop touching it. Well, it's permanently fixated on the VCA slider.
You reckon you might be able to get in there just with a bit of, what's it called? It's, in America, it's deoxit. I don't know what we call it.
Well, I don't know. I don't think it's the slider.
No.
Necessarily, because it doesn't matter where you put the slider, up or down. When you look at it, you can see the virtual version of the slider floating up and down a few fractions of a decibel either way, and it kind of oscillates. So it's like the actual VCA itself is sort of it's in some unstable situation. I can't really. And I thought, is there some sort of modulation in the mod matrix being fed into it? But I did a complete factory reset, and I also did a complete calibration sweep, which is a process that I've not had to do before. Which is quite interesting and takes about 50 minutes.
Oh, wow. Okay. Is that a self-calibration or do you have to go and min-max all the sliders?
Well, I did it twice and I min-maxed all the sliders and I will do it again because it seemed to improve after a calibration run. You can also get it to jettison all that calibration information, start from scratch.
Nice.
First, I did the calibration on the whole system. You can either go in and calibrate individual areas like the oscillators and the LFOs and so forth. Or you could just say all, and it, as I say, it's about a 50-minute process where it goes through everything. So I did that, left it alone, and then I came back and did the VCA on its own. It did improve the functionality to a degree, but it's still got this fixation. So I will have another couple of goes, but I don't, you know, I didn't pay a lot for the unit, and it intrinsically works, so, you know, I'm not worried about it. And I didn't noticeably hear it in the audio, if you know what I'm saying. I didn't hear the sort of the slight difference. It's just the visual. So it might be a false sort of signal or something. It's hard to say, but knowing that there's most probably only a couple of circuit boards in the whole thing and it's well beyond its warranty, there's not a lot I can do.
Yeah. I suppose if it is the fader that's doing some weird stuff, it potentially could be a replaceable one.
Yeah, I don't think it's the fader, though, as such. I mean, it might be. I mean, I don't know how, at what stage the digital part intersects with the analog part and where it sits. However, it reads where the controls are. It's reading that there are some change. So whether, as I say, whether it's the VCA that's fluctuating because there's an unstable component, yeah, or whether for some reason thinks that there's fluctuating information coming from the slider.
Yeah, so you got deep into the deep mind, but maybe not the interesting bits of the deep mind, just the nitty-gritty control.
Yeah, it also led me to get into the virtual software controller.
Oh, yeah.
Which is something I hadn't used, which is a virtual representation of the DeepMind. And you can connect via USB to, I assume it works on, well, it does work on Mac or PC. Mm. And it allows you to configure. And also those movements, the VCA fluctuation was translated on screen onto the virtual version. So the information's been shared. But it allows you to manipulate the DeepMind from the PC. And I would imagine you could possibly use it as a plugin, so you could automate that within your door.
Imagine, yeah, you could just do some MIDI automation. It'd probably be all right.
Not that I've tried it, but I'm just assuming that is going to be an available function, because why else would you want it if you've already got the instrument next
yeah,
to you?
Yeah, totally.
But it was quite interesting. It worked really well, really easy to set up. But again, you know, having had the original DeepMind 12 for at least 4 years now, I got it quite promptly after it was released. And I've never had the need to go in as deep as I did. Quite like it when I'm forced to get really deep inside something that I've had for quite some time, which is quite often the case. I'll buy something and then I'll play around with it and find the patches I like and try and understand how I can use it. But I don't get that embroiled because I'm so distracted by everything else that I've got here.
Yeah.
I'm really having to sort of get the manual out, really... You know, it's almost like the deadline analogy you did earlier. You've got a problem and you've got to fix it. So, alas, I didn't quite fix my problem, but I did explore the inner regions of the deep mind quite deeply. A lot of use of the word deep there.
Yeah. Any other synths that you've got about that you wouldn't mind a bit of an excuse to plumb the depths of?
Let me have a think which ones I'm sort of scanning around. I mean, there's quite a few modules in my Eurorack system that I really haven't explored deeply enough, and there's quite a lot to them.
They're the menuer, heavier ones.
Yeah, the one I was contemplating the other day was the Circadian Rhythms, the tip-top audio.
And although I've got it, type grid thing.
Yeah, barely used it.
Oh, yeah.
And I really should do it some justice and get... But there's quite a hefty manual with it. There's a lot of... A lot of study is required to get the grip of it.
Yeah, when there's something that has such deep functionality, I do appreciate a screen, just so there's words to know where you are, instead of just the dots in the grid telling you what's going on.
I mean, to be honest, I mean, obviously some instruments are very superficial and there's not a lot below the covers, which I like in their own right, like the Arp Odyssey.
Yeah.
It's all there. You know, you just got to sort of learn its sort of quirks and understand how to get sound out of it. Or MS-20, the Korg MS-20, that's another one that's, you know, yes, there's a bit of patching, and again, you can sort of improve your technique with that. But generally, on the whole, it's mostly, you know, it's all there on the control surface. Yeah. Not too much. It's anything with any sort of serious level of menus.
Yeah, definitely. That's the Electron syndrome, is having to learn a new operating system.
How deep do you want to go?
Yeah. Especially when you get into all the really, really deep sort of MIDI sequencing in like the Digitact and things like that. Or because you were stuck in sending sort of program changes and things to try and change pedals or something at one point, weren't you?
Yeah, I was exploring all the MIDI possibilities. But I kind of hit the buffers a bit with the Digitact, especially with no song mode. It really is designed to be a sort of in-the-moment type of, what would you call it, sampling drum machine.
It's a bit more of a jamming type box.
And I would have really appreciated, I don't know if they have, I doubt they've got any intentions, but I would have really appreciated a song mode. That would have really made it.
Especially after, I mean, it's been out so long. I'm actually kind of curious. I wonder how long it's been out. Do you want to place your bets?
Good 3 years, I want to say.
2017, so a little bit longer. That was...
4 years.
April 2017, yeah.
Well, that would have been around NAMM, wouldn't it?
That was a NAMM release, yeah.
So I don't know, did they have it ready like a lot of manufacturers, or was it another 6 months before it sprung forth onto the retail scene?
Yeah, I think Electron aren't too bad for that kind of thing. I don't think they're not teenage engineering, let's put them that way. Yeah.
But I've said many times, I'm ready to possibly make a move and replace the Digitech.
Oh, yeah.
Or Well, we've said before, the 1010 Music Black Box
is
a potential, and that does have a song mode and a lot of flexibility.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
but it's a totally different concept.
Little teeny tiny thing as well.
Also like the fact that I could get complete drum loops in rather than having separate percussive things. So it would behave more like a door in a box.
Yeah. A little bit closer to the full complement of functions. Nice one. And if we circle back once more to actually using our time effectively, you might be able to use some of that time to dig into those new sequential updates. Do you want to jump into those?
Yes, I'm feeling quite vindicated, to be really honest.
I know, we were chatting about this before. It's really funny.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's not a red-hot piece of news. It's a couple of weeks old, but I haven't had time to mention it on the show before. Sequential have released an OS update for the Prophet 6 and the Obi 6, which adds some very key features. It's going to give it MPE support. Mm-hmm. So we
Good
often
flavor.
Talk about polyphonic aftertouch and, you know, the joys of that, and the particular instruments that respond to it and the particular controls that can dish it out. The fact that this is going to be brought to those keyboards is particularly joyous to me because I've got both of them.
Awesome.
But still, I think it's quite an interesting prospect that you'll be able to get that extra expression out of these two units, which are both really good in themselves anyway.
Definitely.
But the second piece, which brings a big grin to my face, is the fact that they're effectively adding the vintage mode to both of these. So this leads back to where we were discussing the Prophet 5.
By discussing, do you mean ranting?
Yes, just well, we always rant. That's what we do.
Yeah.
And I think I've mostly mentioned that I'm subsequently still not very impressed after having a good old play with a Prophet 5 a couple of months ago before putting one out on display. And they are quite a thing to behold, and there's lots of wood. Quite frankly, I've always said that the Prophet 6 is a much better value proposition than the Prophet 5.
Totally.
It sort of does the same things. And my premise is that the Prophet 6 is the culmination of 40 years of Dave Smith's development, whereas the Prophet 5 is a throwback to 1979.
Definitely.
I know that it's got a certain tone, and there is a certain cachet to having a retro release like that. You know, it's still an exorbitant amount of money for something that you can get from Sequential, which is, I think, is just as good, if not better, because of the extra features, which is the Prophet 6. And now you've got the vintage mode. So you've got, I'm assuming that will give you complete slop across the thing, whereas you could get a bit of slope on the oscillators, but the point of it is that the envelopes would have some slop in them as well.
Yeah.
So if you can recreate that in both these synths, I think that really sort of backs up my point about
them. Just adds a bit of that fun squish.
Yeah.
Okay, here's a question. Let's say the update suddenly comes with a free MPE controller of your choice, because of course it does. Which would you pick to control your newly MPE'd?
Well, of course it's going to be the Expressive E Osmos.
That is the only option, as far as I'm concerned.
But I haven't yet seen one in the flesh. I'm not sure when we will see one.
Not many people have.
We do sell the Expressive...
The touche
looks like something you sort of fix your shoes. Looks like a shoe last.
Yeah,
that's what it reminds me of.
It does.
Who knows when we will see them? I assume they're going forward.
Yeah,
with these.
Assuming they get distributed by the same people, they'll be on our radar. And I really hope I get to play with one. They seem super cool. I won't be able to do it justice, but I'll be able to make some strange wibbles with it. That'll be fun.
The Osmos is still in the deepest, darkest recesses of my shopping list.
Well, yeah, it's a feature of the first ever episode of Rack Addicts After Hours. We were going, oh, this is super cool, and look what we still can't buy.
And how long is that now?
Year and a half or something? I don't know. And it was probably in development a lot longer than that, but we'll see.
Just shows you how difficult it is for these smaller companies to get things going.
Yeah, totally.
But yeah, so I'm generally going back to the Sequential announcement. I will be applying both these OS updates to my units here. I haven't got anything that will dish out MPE as yet, but when the Expressive E Osmos appears, I think I'll get one, even though it's not going to be cheap. It's another one. It's going to be one of these.
Yeah, that'll be quite a controller. Do you have the... you just got modules for both of those?
I've got the keyboard version of the OB6 and the module version of the Prophet 6.
Gotcha.
I do have a hankering to get the keyboard version of the Prophet 6, though.
It'll be quite a stack of synthesizer, because obviously the two analog beasties. But then the Osmos has the Harkin. Yeah, the Harkin Continuum engine, synth engine in it, which is super cool. The name is quite fun, but I've totally forgotten. Damn, that's going to annoy me. I'm going to have to Google that one. I must
Google away. I can Harkin. Google away. I can
synth engine. Egan Matrix. Egan Matrix. I don't know. It's a digital modular synthesizer developed by Edmund Egan, or Egan, and it's super cool and sounds amazing, especially from, I'm pretty sure we recommended this when we first spoke about the Osmos, the Cuckoo demo. Ooh, that's great stuff.
Yeah, we did discuss it then.
From lovely stuff onto slightly less lovely stuff. We've been speaking about cassettes and tape and things a little bit recently. Bit of sad news, Lou Ottens, who's credited with the invention of the cassette tape, has passed away at aged 94. He invented this one in 1963 when he was at Philips. It's part of the solution, trying to escape the bulky reel-to-reel stuff of the time. It was a sensation when it was released. Apparently, oh, you know, cassette smaller than a pack of cigarettes. And of course, you know, it spawned a whole wave of personal portable audio type systems with the, you know, the Walkman and everything. And we got some fun figures. In 2020, the cassette has seen more than double the sales since the last year. This is just UK figures, but you know, it's coming back. I'm not sure. For me, as we mentioned last week, and I think the week before, since I can't actually listen to mine, I think there is, it's mostly still going to be a novelty, a bit of a collectibleness, being strapped into the digital media bandwagon for so long. It's been a good while since a lot of people will have either, you know, held a CD or flipped over a cassette, that kind of thing. That's another reason that vinyl is quite important to me as well, is holding your music, and you make an event out of it. You sit back and you listen all the way through your favorite album. So I'm pleased it's coming back.
Yeah, it's been a long time since music was a tangible product.
Definitely. And with live performances being one of the main, I suppose tangible isn't quite the right word, but you know, it makes music an event. With those going missing this year, physical media, that's where it's at for me. Actually, one thing that is really fun is after watching way too many Heinbach videos, is getting a microcassette dictaphone, just for that fun,
just for that
experimental
thing. Anyway,
it's brilliant.
Well, hold the stop the press. Your life might change. I have something here for you.
Oh, he's holding a Sony Walkman in front of my face over Zoom. That means I may be able to listen to. That is the sound of Galactic Bathtub by Robert Rhodes, which will soon be available on your favourite streaming service when I eventually pay to get on PRS. I'll do that eventually, but that's incredible. Thank you so much, Pete.
No problem at all. I knew there was one in the studio somewhere. I was on my hands and knees crawling around under desks.
The back of some dusty drawer somewhere.
And I knew there was one in there. I couldn't work out with one of the sporty yellow ones that used to get that were sort of semi-waterproof.
Oh, yeah.
But this is just a straightforward, very late generation Walkman with mega bass.
I was on eBay when we mentioned it last on the podcast. I did notice that quite a lot. I didn't realize the bass tuning went back so far.
I don't think I've had the occasion to use a cassette for a long time in any shape or form, apart from that story about that music that I'd dragged up from the 80s to listen to. There was another. I mean, my relationship with cassettes is always a bit fraught because I always relate it to stuff we recorded and that possibly wasn't that good or was a bit embarrassing. There was subsequently another single that we made in the late 80s, I want to say. Late 80s, very beginning of the 90s, late 80s. And we were very pleased with it, but again, we went to the studio and it didn't work out. It was working out in my little home studio quite well. And then when I took it into a big studio, I kind of lost control of it. And the production kind of, I'm a bit embarrassed about it. And I believe I've got several hundred copies of it on cassette somewhere in a loft somewhere.
If they resurface.
Hopefully never to be seen again. I mean, they're mostly deteriorated quite badly. That magnetic stuff gets bombarded with cosmic rays, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And starts losing its... And also, what else have we got up there? I think I've got some 8-track reel-to-reel tapes.
Nice.
Good grief. I don't know what will be on there. I haven't got a machine to play it on, so I wouldn't know.
Maybe you're thanking your lucky stars. You can't hear what's on it at the moment.
again, it goes back to what I was saying about finishing off projects. I mean, the initial ideas can be really good and they could be something really good, but it's, you've got to have the right production is so important, you know, to get something from a good sketch to a completed product.
Yeah,
it's the task.
Outside of the relentless march of technology, I suppose there is something to be said of just having the project there just in audio file form. Because, of course, it's relatively easy to drag and drop these days, but that would be free from plug-in strife or DAWs changing, computers changing, I mean, relatively speaking anyway.
Yeah.
But, of course, you'll then lose a bit of control, and it'd be really tedious to back up. My dad has just finished rebacking up the old backups from when we used to back up things to CDs, because that was cheap and easy.
Yeah.
And he just destroyed the last ancient hard drive as well, sort of reprocessing those backups. For him, it's pretty much entirely pictures, but they go back a long way.
Yeah, I've got lots of hard copy pictures as well, and I think I've still got the negatives. I really should spend a lot of time scanning them in, but it's pretty tedious stuff.
Yeah, actually, one really cool thing about my EP and the cassette is the image on it is a film picture taken by my dad that I think he still has the negative of. So not only is it a newfangled digitally made EP, but it's on a cassette, and the picture was film. That's pleasantly tactile for me. Love it. And that takes us through our news. Not a lot, and we got a lot of time out of those bits of news. But thankfully, Luke is here to rescue us from the mire of dredging the bottom of certain news websites. And it's time for Luke's Spacey Bit.
Hello, space fans. I hope you're safe and well, and that the universe is being kind to you. Scientists from JPL recently published a paper announcing the discovery of 4 strains of bacteria living on the ISS, 3 of which were previously unknown to science. They are not of the void. When they were sequenced, it was discovered that their genetic roots lay in soil-based bacteria. These particular bacteria are related to others that aid in nitrogen fixation and plant growth, making them useful for plants as they develop. The new bacteria have yet to be officially classified, but the name Mycelobacterium ajmali has been suggested by the researchers in honour of the renowned biodiversity scientist Ajmal Khan. Given that these bacteria are present in the hostile environment of space, it is logical to think that they may well be useful for helping to grow future crops in space, and may well be selected as part of a botanist's toolkit for providing the fertile soil needed. More evidence and testing would be required to say for sure, however. When I first heard about this story, I was initially alarmed and wondered, how is it that we are going to find microbial life on Mars or other planets and be able to determine whether or not it is extraterrestrial in origin if we're still finding new bacteria in and around the confines of Earth and our orbiting islands like the ISS? Well, the fact of the matter is, we just don't know. It's a major concern when sending a robotic probe out to another planet or planetoid that we're going to infect it with Earth-based bacteria and ruin our chances of finding genuine alien life, either by killing it with our own hardy and persistent microbes, or perhaps even worse, creating a false positive scenario, somewhat similar to the situation on the ISS where we may, in inverted commas, discover a new bacteria on Mars, but turn out to be that it's one that we brought with us that we just hadn't found before. Scientists at institutions like JPL bear this in mind when they build probes and rovers for extraterrestrial exploration. Perseverance and all the rovers before it are assembled under strict hygiene control conditions, partially to see that nothing damages or infests the sensitive and expensive equipment, but also to avoid coating it in Earth-based microbial life. Engineers are dressed head to toe in PPE regardless of any pandemics and work in strictly controlled clean rooms. Parts are handled with gloves and machines and are rigorously wiped down with alcoholic solutions to kill even the hardiest of bacteria. That said, as we all well know now more than ever these days, you cannot guarantee 100% effectiveness, particularly not in an environment in which humans are present. Fortunately, the violence of launching a rocket into space is on our side. Any Mars-bound bacteria from Earth have to survive the conditions of a clean room, the scouring heat and pressure of a trip through the atmosphere on a rocket, and then many months in the freezing radiation-filled vacuum of space before possibly arriving at their destination. But even then, our rovers, clean as can be, probably still bring something of our microscopic fauna with them to their new environments. It's a problem we cannot get away from. But because this is the case, we have to admit it's either we do this, or we sit on our hands, never daring to disturb the environments of another world. We might fail to detect life on Mars thanks to interference from our own biosphere, but if we don't look, we will always have failed. Besides the stringent care taken in assembling exploratory craft, our scientists have lots of methods for telling bacteria apart from one another anyway. It is likely that we will be able to tell a Martian bacterium, possibly a fossil at this stage, from a Terran one. The aforementioned Mycelobacterium were sampled in 2015 and 16, and in just 5 years we were able to discover, analyse, and understand exactly what they are and where they might have come from, just based on examination of their genes. With science we can do amazing things when we try, and this is just one very small example. That brings us to the end of the segment, and with the permission of producer Pete, I would like to introduce a new way to end the show, or my part of it anyway. I like to fold my story into a link to a piece of science fiction, but this is not always possible, however, so today I'm just going to recommend a new book I'm reading. It is A Memory Called Empire by Arkady Martine. The story of a young ambassador to a powerful empire finding herself amid a dangerous political landscape and conspiracy that she was not prepared for in the slightest. I haven't finished it yet, but it's a beautiful and well-crafted world with an interesting naming conventions a la E.L.M. Banks. The audiobook I'm currently listening to is narrated by Amy Landon, who does an excellent job of capturing the nuanced relationship our protagonist has with her liaisons in this powerful alien culture that she must immerse herself in. It's science fiction, yes, but it's also a political thriller, and I thoroughly recommend giving it your time. That's it from me now. I will return you to our co-host for the time being. Stay safe. Bye-bye.
Well, we can't have an episode of Rack Addicts After Hours without the horrible mess of alliteration that the miscellaneous multimedia recommendation is. Alliteration.
Recommendation. We're going to have to do a little audio musical link for that.
Yeah, I've got no ideas at the moment, but we'll brew something up, probably with a bit of help from Telmo, potentially. Telmo's miscellaneous multimedia recommendation. Who knows? Either way, Pete, what media have you consumed using your eyes and ears?
As normal, YouTube. I've been indulging in some blatant wealth porn.
Oh, yes. Like the ultra mansions and yachts and things.
Yeah, exactly that. And there's quite a lot of it on YouTube. And I have spats of it. It's just sort of fantasy shopping, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
It's, you know, there's no way that mere mortals would be able to afford any of this.
Yeah, and you look at one tour and you realise, oh, no, I wouldn't have that one. The staircase is all wrong.
Yeah, yeah, you start getting fussy.
Totally.
The one I've been focusing on, and it seems to be quite a successful channel, has come up a bit, and it's just entitled Inez Imaza, which is the gentleman's name. I'll spell that. I'll most probably butchered the name a bit. It's E-N-E-S, and then Y-I-L-M-A-Z-E-R.
No idea. Anyway.
Well, yeah, N-S. Yeah, anyway. He goes to, I mean, invariably he's doing a lot of the sort of California type properties, but he has been to New York and Lake Tahoe and a few other places, but predominantly they are around the LA area, and it'll be your typical starting between 7 million up to 50 million or, you know, anything in between.
Pocket change.
And they're all either, you know, some of the new builds, some of, and they've been what they call dressed, where they actually put the furniture in.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
To demonstrate it, or occasionally there will be someone's actual home, but invariably these are obviously super rich people. It doesn't look like it's been lived in anyway.
Yeah, because it's their holiday home for the holiday they never take.
They either have that sort of mid-century modern, as they like to call it, or that indoor-outdoor bit, especially the ones in LA, where the sort of lounge and kitchen sort of flows into the sort of patio and then into the infinity pool.
Yeah, past the waterfalls as well. the indoor tree.
Yeah, that sort of thing. And invariably they'll have 7 bedrooms, but it'll have 12 bathrooms.
I mean, how could you live like that? Not enough bedrooms.
You know, gym, spa, you know, everything in there. It's just a bit of escapism. I know it's a bit obscene in some respects, but yeah, and that's why these channels are so successful. It's reasonably well filmed and he's very slick. I mean, he comes across, I don't know if he's works in real estate, and I don't know, obviously these things are edited, but even the sort of flowing pieces of camera where he's walking around the house, he describes it very well and makes it very you know, appealing. So that's what I've been watching.
Yeah, nice one. I did enjoy some of the ultra yacht stuff that I think you recommended quite early on. Those are good fun. Mine has a similarly interesting issue with pronunciation. It's the channel, a YouTube channel, is Mizziziziz, a sort of gaming YouTuber. It's M-I-Z-I-Z-I-Z-I-Z. I don't know. There is a video where he explains it. But either way, I actually, this is hot off the press, not because they're recent videos, but because I found them today. But it's a quick sort of dev log, a development log of just a video game. So this is in the Godot engine, G-O-D-O-T, kind of, we're looking at sort of PS1 type graphics, which is, it's actually quite endearing seeing that kind of thing now. And it's can potentially be a little bit easier to do. Develop when you only have a certain number of polygons to worry about. Anyway, it's making a sort of a first person shootery, slightly tribesy, movementy thing. I think the genre called it as a biopunk RPG. But no, it's just interesting, like problem solving things that you totally wouldn't expect, not knowing anything about game development. Like he was trying to make a grenade launcher and was sort of looking at how to do the maths for that, you know, arcing projectile, and how to do the AI for the enemies shooting them. And there was some interesting sort of maths involved, which was quite cool, because I do enjoy a bit of maths sometimes if I remember it from the A-level days. But no, it's pretty cool. So if you search, I think the name changed from Thouest Thee, which is a terrible name. Now it's called Wrought Flesh. So wrought as in wrought iron. It's pretty kind of gory and weird, but it's quite enjoyable watching how this one grows. He just added a few more enemy types in the most recent episode. It's pretty cool. I think that one of the bosses was, is it set in the desert? It was like a kind of, you know, the big worms from Dune. But he thought, oh yeah, I want to make this kind of sandworm. But then all his concept sketches were just too derivative. So one of the discussions was how to make some monsters and things that weren't just blatant rip-offs of everything that's come before.
Well, everything's a rip-off of everything else, isn't it? Well, not everything, but so many things have been taken from Dune. I mean, the sandworm things has been done numerous times.
Yeah, and I mean, he acknowledges it when he does as well. It's like, but I didn't want to make it too obvious. So, I mean, he's got this gun that I think shoots ticks, which is horrible, but it's loosely based on the Needler from Halo. But no, that's really cool. I would recommend checking it out if you're into your video games and potentially interested in making them.
Okay.
That'll wrap us up. Once again, on the end of another Rack Addict After Hours. The weather's getting slightly better here, so we are hoping one day to be allowed back into a park with our friends and our headsets. We'll let you know when that happens, because we'll probably be the cheeriest we possibly could be, given that we're actually from England. Anyway, thank you for your listenage, and we hope you tune in next week. Thank you for listening to Rack Addicts After Hours. Farewell.